So what did I just say? Repeat back to me what I just said so I can repeat it. Yeah, this is a model. There's good things and bad things. And again, for a while there, as I was going through it really carefully for a class, I thought, uh-oh. Maybe he is writing badly in this, because it's probably his only book that was critically not that well received. But the political stuff was pretty complicated. And this Yale professor of Spanish, I just don't think is a very smart guy, and just took this as a defense of Christopher Columbus and didn't see that Greenblatt's really, I mean, I think it really clearly just trying to get beyond that issue, all right? He says really clearly here, I mean, that he's just looking at the first day, October 12th, and it's pretty hard to blame Christopher Columbus for stuff that happened 100 years later, you know, based on what he did the first day. Maybe what he did the second day, okay, but the first day, it's tough. So what did you think of this before I... Right. Yeah, I think it's just because he doesn't accentuate the condemnation of Columbus. He runs it as a subtext. Right. This is one of the complicated things about writing I want to try and get across here. He's got a main argument he's making about Christopher Columbus's rhetoric, right? And he fills in lots of details to keep you going. And then that filler, which is always in subordinate positions, but he gets it in there. So he's running two arguments, his structure, and then, you know, here's what you need to know. And we all have to write this way. You have to get stuff in there without letting it overwhelm your topic. And he does that really well. But if you're just, I think, looking at the rhetorical analysis of Christopher Columbus, you might, look back at your notes and forget that all the stuff he'd thrown in there, really in throwaway lines and subordinate clauses and prepositional phrases, right, where he just makes it really clear that Columbus was a very bad boy. All right. Right at the end of the first page there, the violent encounter of civilizations, the missionary enterprise, mass enslavement, and death. You can't get much more strong than that, but it's sort of a throwaway at the end of the line, and the sentence ends, the immense project of colonization. And that's not a very strong condemnation of anything. It's a kind of neutral phrasing. So the harsh... statement is mass enslavement and death, okay? But he's buried it, right? Because I think it's because he's really moving on. Right? He's trying to get you to see I'm not just like surprise. Hey, surprise! You know, Columbus, think bad things happened. All right, okay. I think he's assuming an audience that's sort of already. There. Well, what else did you notice about this? Any particular detail or fact? The one thing that you remember from your blurred reading of this text? Right. It does certainly start with a block quote. Carol, what are you? This is your stuff. Did you notice anything or remember?
No, I thought it was interesting. There were lots of things that I didn't remember.
Right, that used to be the word, and this was written, came out for 1992, so this guy's good to get a major book on Columbus out in time for 1992, which was the 500th anniversary. And people like me just sort of opening our eyes, and the big guys already have books, they plan 10 years in advance, right, so that they'd have a major book to sell during the appropriate time period. But even the general public was aware that there was a debate about, well, not a debate, but you're not supposed to say Columbus discovered America because there were people already here. So the phrase we learn in school, Columbus discovered America, the people were looking for another way to say it, and then lots of people defended him because he did, from his point of view, discover America. So, and you can see the Italian Anti-Defamation League leading the charge to defend Christopher Columbus, and they did. Oh, sorry about that. Am I Italy or Genovese? Right. He's from Genoa, she couldn't care. Okay. Yeah, what?
And then I know this is the point of his article, that, Columbus supposedly was meaning to keep repeating the word marvelous, but I was kind of humored by it, just how, like, every single thing includes, marvelous.
Yeah, this is one of those arguments. Let me talk about that. He certainly jumps all over the word marvelous, right? And right there in that first quote, you can see it three lines from the end, right? Who has marvelously bestowed all this. And he wants to make a big deal out of it. And he's got this huge problem. And I want to see how he handles that, because the huge problem is Columbus uses that word all the time. So somebody could easily say, hey, it's meaningless. And you can see guys like Greenblatt get to give their papers on this and have brilliant discussions, and then they can go back and revise. But you can see he's got a problem. And I might even add, he may be wrong. This is the thing to remember when you're writing a dissertation. He may, even after all his defense of the word marvelous, he shows how it changes, he may still be wrong, and it's just a throwaway word for Columbus. It doesn't matter. I hope you understand. We're in the humanities. We're not sending a rocket ship to the moon. He makes the strongest argument he can for the meaning of the word marvelous, gives the counterexample, and maybe you believe the counterexample, and certainly the next person to write on this is going to come along and say, I think he's wrong. Right? So it doesn't matter that he's wrong. And when you write on any kind of literary criticism, you have to get your own point of view, and you just don't worry about whether you're right. You just do the best you can. I mean, that's just a great attitude, because you're looking at two sides anyway, and it's probably a close call, right? And you come down this way. Oh, yeah, the marvelous is significant, right? And you could have done it the other way, right? So there, that was a discourse on the word marvelous. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. He starts crafting a definition of the marvelous and opposing it to, really, it's a different thing from C.S. Lewis with the supernatural. Maybe it is. It might be the same thing. That would be an interesting essay. But he certainly opposes it to the monstrous. What is this marvel or wonder? And at the end of the essay, and I haven't quite figured out how he gets away with doing all the literary theory at the end. I guess it's because in the 16th century, people, particularly in Italy, they talked about marvels. They read poems like Boiardo and Ariosto, and they said, these things are full of crazy marvels. There's a flying horse. How can a serious person read a poem about a flying horse? This will lead right into your magical realism for next week. And the theorists had to think about it. Well, here you go. They may be dead wrong. Hey, you're right. When you're writing a poem about a flying horse, that's pretty stupid. I'd rather write about Hamlet's mental crisis. There's what poetry should be about, about murdering King Duncan, assassination of Caesar, things that count, right? Not flying horses, right? Nonetheless, people defended them. And Tasso, the Italian poet, was the great the best defender. He says, why do you put the marvelous in? Why the flying horse? Because everybody likes it. Okay. That's how you sell your books. People love these flying horses. I haven't got to the part yet, but I'm sure that's sneaking up on me in the 100 years of solitude. Oh, the Wonder Camera.
Yeah.
And the monstrous and the exotic went together because they figured if you went far enough, okay, you would get strange examples of X, Y, or Z, right? Dragons or something. And even Ariosto's flying horse is said to come from the Riphaean Mountains, which would be, you know, eastern Russia, where you can be sure nobody is going to go to check whether they have flying horses there, right? A lot of the marvels, the taste for the marvels came from Marco Polo's trip to China, where he came back and wrote this whole big book called Il Milione, just full of the wonders he saw. I mean, Darwin? He's doing his field work in the 1830s. When Origin of Species comes out in 1859. We should pause over that. You should know 1859. It's the watershed year in world culture. Okay, and there's a question: what are the three famous books? And I can't remember the third one. All right, but Darwin's Origin of Species was published in 1859, and even though it didn't have to, intellectually, it was the moment where you had to decide that the biblical story of creation had to be wrong. It could not be 6,000 years and account for not just the fossil evidence that everybody knew about and the geological evidence, but now the mutation of species, right? That the bird you see was not the one God planted in the Garden of Eden, because you're able to show this development. So 1859 is just a huge moment in the world. The other book is, one of the books that's written in is George Eliot's Middlemarch. And all English majors should read Middlemarch. And it's a watershed too, because it's the story of a village life. And George Eliot is a woman. Right? And this is, you can, like Jane Austen, right? But this is, George Eliot's an intellectual of the highest order, and she's reading German philosophy, and she's writing brilliant novels. There's nothing like this in history, okay, before Middlemarch. I'm trying to remember it. I think of it, I flunk, I fail. Maybe it's a Dickens novel or something, I don't know. I'd have to go back. It's got to be something really watershed, like. Yeah, I mean, I think it's English, but, you know, I could leave it. We could try and, let's just, you know, I'll think about it. No, it doesn't strike me as that it's War and Peace.
What year was Middlemarch published?
1859, same year as The Origin of Species. And Darwin had been sitting on it for 25 years. I mean, he had an aunt who was incredibly religious, and he was hoping she'd die before he published the book, because it would shake her up. All right. But he finally had to do it because it was getting out and there was other things, competition. So intellectually, everybody knew what was coming. But for the public, the publication of the book was... it might have been something like Lincoln debates with Douglas or something like that. I don't know. So the American Civil War was no small thing in the history of the world. All right, so we talked about the word marvelous a bit. How about the word possession? What does he mean by that?
Well,
Right, that's one of them. The word marvelous, he eventually gets into the rhetoricians and the theorists about poetry. It's a technical word, and his examples are from the 16th century, but he says it's the kind of thing people were conscious of. Columbus is constantly writing those descriptions of how beautiful the land is, lying his head off, probably. The mountains are taller than Tenerife. They're not, okay? But it's the same thing that makes Greenland Greenland, right? Trying to get people, you want to make it look attractive. Right? So marvelous is a rhetorical term. What discourse does possessions come from? How do you possess something? Hey, could you just give me your shoes? You go, no, this isn't Napoli, Naples. You got some shoes? You got two? I got none? Give me one. Yeah, siamo amici. We're friends, right? We should split. Right? Right. How come you don't want to give me your shoes? No, it's all right. No, because they're yours, right?
Yeah.
They're your possession. So where's the possession? What discourse? Yeah. Legal. It's a legal term. Okay? It's more than just having something. It's having the right to it. And the whole thing, this whole opening paragraph, is Columbus claiming the right to the island of Hispaniola. And on what? And there's two things. There's two ways to look at this. Was he right to claim it? And Greenblatt says, I can't even get into that one. It's too crazy. And the second one is, how does he claim it? And we look at the language he uses. So he's a literary scholar. So we just look at the language. Well, let's go back to the. You know, by what right could he imagine that he could claim this island? He's just sailed from, across the ocean. He hasn't landed in Brazil. He's landed on an island. He seems to have a fair idea that it's an island, even after just a day or two. Right? Although it's pretty big. I mean, Hispaniola is the island of, the Caribbean, actually. San Salvador? Is that the name of the island? It's Haiti and the Dominican Republic today, right? Okay, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, out there on the sort of eastern side of the islands, the Caribbean. Okay, the word Caribbean, by the way, comes from the Carib Indians that seem to live there, and everybody, all the explorers assumed that they were cannibals. But they used to call there were always stories of cannibals. Marco Polo talks about cannibals in the Gobi Desert on the way to China. People always expect people to eat people. So these stories went around that there were cannibalism going on among the Indians. But the word they used to use was anthropophagi, anthropophagi, man-eaters, anthro, Greek for man. Fagi, F-A-G-I, eaters. But after Columbus got to the Caribbean, they developed a new word for man-eaters based on the Carib Indians. And when they slurred it and changed it, Caribbean turned into Caribbean, became cannibal. Okay? So we get the word cannibal from the Caribbean Indians. He doesn't get into this, but were they eating people? Well, I don't know about that one, but there was, the other big accusation is that these Indians practiced human sacrifice. And unfortunately, they were practicing human sacrifice, at least among the Aztecs. So they had a little problem there that, but Greenblatt sort of skirts around that. Anyway, so we have two discourses. We have the marvelous and we have possessions, right? And if you think about it, he spends a lot of time talking about these things. So just a little hint, when you title your chapter something like, do you think his chapter is well titled?
Well, in the sense of the two things you're talking about.
Yeah, I hope you get the idea, right? When you have a chapter title, it should summarize what you're going to talk about. And if you call it Marvelous Possessions, hey, you got your work done for you. You better be talking about the marvelous for half that chapter, and you better be talking about possessions for the other half, okay? But it's actually not that simple, because he's really talking about the incompatibility of these two ideas, isn't it? How they don't go together, how that they really jar, and how you can't, and that's why Columbus is so weird. But he doesn't title the chapter The Incompatibility of the Marvelous and the Legal Concept of Possessions, right? But if it was his dissertation, he probably should have, all right? But again, that's why I'm just saying he's a little advanced here. But the logic and the thought process is the same. Now, if we go to the end somewhere, let me get the right page here. What's the big thing? He comes to a big conclusion, and there's actually a third thing going on, or a third topic. Maybe there's two more topics. Yeah, naming, right? That's how he kind of ends up the whole shebang. He's got the incompatibility of the rhetorical marvelous and the legal possessions, and the solution to that incompatibility is the power that derives from naming things, right? Which he also doesn't put in the chapter title. But we have a sentence here on page, and normally I would think you would want to signal that, you know, the marvelous possessions and naming. That would be the more standard title, but he's being, you know, he's writing. He's written three books, but he gets to use shorthand. Yeah. You might, right, exactly. In other words, it comes out of it. So possessions gets okay, very good. It's almost, you might even say it's a Hegelian thesis, antithesis, synthesis. In other words, you got marvelous, you've got the possessions, and then the solution is the naming thing. So maybe it's a part of possessions, maybe it's part of both of these things. And if you look at page 83, the end of the second paragraph, I think that's the only time, page 83, did I cut off the page numbers? It's the one next to the picture. I'm sorry, yeah. Yeah, all right. Well, I don't Xerox so well, right? What else? I do see my sentence. From legal ritual, through the experience of the marvelous, you girls see that? Yeah. To the mystical understanding and appropriative power of naming. So he does seem to have a three-part thing, right? And we do know that he doesn't mention naming in the title. So I think Jason's right. It seems to be a part, or you know, you're right. It comes out of those things somehow. Here, I think, cancel the whole thing. Let's start another topic. All right. So you had those three topics. What order are you going to talk about them in? I got possessions, I got marvels, I got naming. No. There's a room, if you need a room, 129 is empty. So, and I'm sure there's other rooms, but this is our scheduled room tonight. Yeah. This is our, we've been scheduled here all semester. Okay, so you're saying the ordering principle is what's most interesting. We go from the interesting to the least interesting. That's it, right? You need an order. If you have three ideas, you got to figure out what order to put them in, whether it's three chapters. He's using, I'm only going to raise the issue here, that he's got to order those three things. And he's probably got a more complicated ordering than I would normally want you to think about, right? Because in this sentence, he makes it clear that you go from legal ritual through the experience of the marvelous to the naming. And that's the general order of his chapter. But he also knows that the conclusion of the chapter should also be, you know, put at the beginning as the thesis. So he knows enough that the reason he even wants to go through this process, this three-step process, is because he's working up to the naming thing. And that, maybe that's a little complicated, but just think of an ordering, there's some kind of ordering principle here, right? And with this naming inherent in the legal ritual, or becoming the kind of key element that he pulls out of it. It's the sort of, again, it's the thing that explains the contradiction between the paradox and between the marvelous and the possession. Okay. You wonder at things that are distant. You own the things that are here. Right? Columbus is doing them both, creating this wonder and grabbing it at the same time. And he stresses that notion of paradox on page 70. I think it's kind of a crucial turning point in the chapter. I think I have it all underlined. Did I do this morning? The end of the first paragraph. I think rather that we are encountering an important aspect of Columbus's page 70. Are you with me? Yeah. Okay. And then the new paragraph. This discursive economy. And Greenback loves these business terms for things that don't really go together. The interrelationship between the rhetorical notion of the marvelous and the legal notion of possession. That's an economy. Okay. Right? A sort of household. This discursive economy brings opposites into the closest conjunction with one another and yet leaves the heart of their relation in mystery. Columbus takes absolute possession on behalf of the Spanish crown in order to make an absolute gift. Now this is summarizing what he's talked about. He takes possession in order to give this to the king. He seeks earthly gain in order to serve a divine purpose. The Indians must lose everything in order to receive everything. Now he just runs all kinds of paradoxes here. Right? But you see how that's the term he uses for the inability, the essential problem that possession is not marvelousness. Right? And he'll get out of it with the naming thing later, but he really wants to hold on to that incompatibility, or what he's calling a paradox. Now what's really fascinating about him, I mean, you got to admit, this is pretty advanced stuff. I mean, I buy it. It looks like good history and everything else. But what's the key to his thought? And the key to his thought seems to be this notion. He's got a very, he knows the paradox when he sees it, more than I do. Okay? And so I had to look it up. You know what a paradox is? Do you know? Oh, yeah? So what is it? I'll put you on the spot. Well, I'll give you the definition. You tell me if it's anywhere close, all right? Or do you want to do it?
No.
Go ahead.
We did
right, forget it. Something that contradicts common sense, but is true. Something that contradicts common sense, that, but is true. Give me an example. See if that fits. Something like a limit then, or a Zeno's paradox, or something like that. Yeah, it doesn't seem to me exactly the same thing that we're talking about here. A stitch in time saves nine, but he who hesitates is lost, or something like that. The Proverbs tend to work in two directions. What's the one with Ophelia and Hamlet? I can't even remember. Hamlet says, your beauty should admit no discourse to your honesty, or something like that.
He says,
Well, the point, whatever paradox means, the punchline for us as literary people here in our couplet seminar is this was the key term of the new criticism. This is how everybody analyzed every single poem there was. This is what you taught in the classroom, to look for tension and paradox in poetry, right, all through the 40s and 50s. And he gives an example right here on page 70. Here's a paradox in a poem by John Donne. Right. That you have to be crushed by God in order to get power. Okay, that's basically what he's saying. That I may rise and stand, overthrow me. If you want to stand up, you have to first be thrown down. That's all. We only need the one example, right? And then the poem is, if we had the whole poem here, we could see that that would be structuring the whole poem. There would be the down part and the up part, and then we'd need to somehow resolve it. But here he just sort of repeats it in different ways. My point that, and the reason I pulled this in last week was, I said, you learn to see the world by reading poetry, right? And, you know, the new criticism is all attacks and everything, and I never really did it myself, but you start seeing paradoxes. Like a Greenblatt would have done this stuff. He would have been an A-plus student reading his done, seeing paradoxes, and well, he's just looking paradox, Columbus, okay, and runs his whole analysis of it. Now, he's smart enough not to you know, to stick with the rhetorical or the word side of Columbus, but he keeps expanding those words so they have all these really large meanings, and there's actually no room left for culture. I mean, by the time you get done with the language and the law, what's left? Okay, is Columbus's bathtub? I mean, it's like... You mean it's too much focus on Columbus as an individual? As right, it's instead of
someone else who is neglected by history, who needs their attention.
I suppose, yeah, that yeah, right. Great man theory of history or something like that.
Thank you.
Right.
If you give them a voice, which other people don't do, I don't know, if you can tell me from that
standpoint. That might be a good place to come back to. Can we take a little break since we've been going? Okay, turn this off. I have a paragraph I'll work with at that point. Okay.